Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Excuse me. Are you Miss Eiffel?
Yes.
Am I interrupted?
Yes.
I'm the assistant your publishers hired.
The publishers think I have writer's block.
Do you have writer's block?
I don't know how to kill Harold and Crick.
This is a story about a man named Harold Crick. Harold lived a life of solitude. He would walk home alone. He would eat alone. When others' minds would fantasize about their upcoming day.
Hello?
Harold just counted brush strokes.
All right, who just said Harold just counted brush strokes?
Welcome to Rewatchability. It's the podcast where we rewatch old movies and see how they hold up today in the modern eye. I'm Robert Lerone. With me, as always, is
Lane Waters. He said his name with a certain fervor to try to get across the audience.
Oh, my God.
Just let's narrate this entire podcast.
Oh, this has gotten pretentious. You know, if your podcast can't stand without narration, then it's really not working, is it?
He said disdainfully.
Blaine was doing his narration thing again. It always drove Robert insane. Once this crisis was over and he could leave his house, he would come and strangle all the life from Blaine's neck.
Oh, God, just from my neck.
Just from your neck. You can have the rest of the life in your body. This is Rewatchability. Thank you for tuning in. I don't remember how we start this podcast.
Well, I think we've already kind of introduced it. We are going to talk about Stranger Than Fiction. This is the follow-up to last week's podcast where we kind of talked about where we first saw it. And
sorry, is this the narrator or is this the character of Blaine speaking?
How dare you? In my book, there's no difference.
Before we get into Stranger Than Fiction, we should first of all thank our Patreons. Yes, those are the people who give us $1, $3, $5 a month, who help keep the podcast going.
I love how you said, yes, those are the people, because you were remembering what they did for us in that moment.
It was more like I was trying to give it like a certain aplomb, like an author would.
Yes.
And the Patreons, in return, would get perks. Podcasts early, they would be delighted to find.
I love how this narrator is so divorced from any technology or understanding of the world.
Yeah.
The narrator, Rob, not you.
Oh, okay. I mean, you know, she got a couple of drafts to do this. This is all, what do you call that? Auto-dictation? we're here to talk about Stranger Than Fiction, the 2006 movie by Mark Forrester, as written by Zach Helm. And last week we talked about our first time seeing the movie and what we remembered about it. It was a good time. And,
I mean, if you didn't experience that, I don't think you truly lived. But this week we are getting into the kind of rundown of the movie and some behind the scenes things that you might not know about this movie, and then we'll see if it's we'll put it to the ultimate test.
Yeah,
the ultimate test, which is it rewatchable?
A stress test. Oh, yes.
So Rob, you want to take the viewers to this movie that maybe they didn't take the week to watch this movie?
Jeez, and they did other work things
like raise their kids. Or right. Work from home, you know.
That's what I've been doing, which is just jerk at home.
Oh, God.
I'm being a jerk at home. I really
need to okay.
better to people around me. Yeah. But
this is an explicit podcast.
Okay, Stranger Than Fiction. So it is a movie about this man played by Will Ferrell. His name is Harold Crick. And he is a very precise man who lives a very precise life. He lives his life counting the number of times he brushes his teeth and counting the steps on the way to the bus stop. And we know all this because the narrator is telling us.
Right. And it's all, you know, you think it would be boring, but they have an upbeat song over it.
So oh, yeah, that's right. Through. Well, you know, this whole movie has music by Spoon.
Yeah.
Which is great because I fucking like Spoon.
Yeah, so good.
Yeah, and actually Britt Daniel of Spoon collaborated with the composer whose last name is Reitzel. No first name. Brian Reitzel.
Madonna.
Collaborated with Brian Reitzel on the score. So that's, you know, so that's why it's all sort of woven through it, but it does have like a good like
yeah, it kind of like when at a certain point Will Ferrell says I wanted a more musical life, I was like, man, you got it, you're in this kind of like upbeat, happy go lucky musical already.
Yeah, I wish my life was scored by Spoon.
yeah Well, and Britt Daniel, you mentioned Veronica Mars last week being in
Edward.
Yeah, but Daniel was in Veronica Mars.
What?
Yeah. Played a song.
Oh, that's awesome. That show was so hip.
Yeah, it was so hip. It was on fire.
But his life is pretty boring. I mean, it's very precise. He is an IRS auditor, which is not a very exciting career, probably. And he lives a very lonely life. He's been doing the same routine for 12 years, and he doesn't talk much, the narrator tells us. So it seems sort of sad. Except one day when he's brushing his teeth, he stops because he hears the narrator talking about brushing his teeth. And this confuses him. He's like, hello?
I feel like one of our perks on Patreon now should be that you narrate someone's life. Because it kind of feels like narration right now, and I'm digging it.
John McClane 64 woke up in a puddle of sweat.
Because Rob is going to be yelling in his ear all day. But he hears the narrator, which is disconcerting. I don't know, sometimes on this newfangled thing we're using, I can hear my own voice, and it is very disconcerting. It's so hard to talk when you hear yourself, or like, you know, your own even thoughts in your brain.
I mean, any sort of disembodied voice is creepy because it doesn't have a body. But I don't like anything that like speaks to me automatically. Like if you go into the beer store here in Ontario, it'll say, there's a voice that says, welcome to the beer store. And I feel weird about not saying thank you. And I was just raised that way. It's polite, you know? Meanwhile, we also meet the aforementioned narrator, played by the great Dame Emma Thompson. And when we meet her, she's imagining herself jumping off a building. She's actually just standing on her desk where she's just trying to get a feel for what it feels like.
She's obsessed with murder and killing people in her books. It is kind of what we're led to believe in this movie. And she kind of imagines all the ways throughout the movie that like she could kill her characters and what that would feel like in order to write about it.
Yeah, and she puts herself into the character's place. It's not like she's imagining Will Ferrell, you know, jumping off the thing. She's imagining herself. Like, important distinction.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, we're also led to believe in the movie that it's kind of her own personal death wish. Is that because she's a smoker, she is obsessed with death in and of herself. So I think she kind of wants to die in a little way.
Probably.
She won't accept help from her assistant, Queen Latifah.
Yes, that's right. Her publisher sends her an assistant, and they do not cheap out because they send Queen Latifah, who is one of the few people who outranks Dame Emma Thompson in court. But
she could lose her head. She really could lose her head.
But actually, yeah. I mean, they should have sent her. Yeah, a therapist would be probably the better thing to do, because you might get one book out of Emma Thompson, but the way she's going, you're probably not going to get much more.
And she seems to have this kind of disdain for any sort of help, like doctors, even or therapists, because she is writing in such a way about Crick's life, where he kind of, sees a therapist at work about maybe this voice and about things that are happening to him. And she hates this therapist. She hates kind of the establishment or people that try to help people. She's pretty cantankerous in a lot of ways.
Yeah, she's great. I love her.
Someone after Rob's own heart. That's great.
I want to be like her when I grow up. I mean, she's, morbid, and she's, also doesn't accept Queen Latifah's help, but Queen Latifah isn't taking no for an answer. So she ends up being dragged out to all these different scenarios where the woman, her name is Karen Eiffel, where she is sort of imagining or experiencing death, or trying to figure out how to kill this character, because apparently she's written the whole book but hasn't figured out the crux of what it's about, which is the death. I mean, it's probably one of the first things. Do an outline.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, sometimes like in writing, you like write a whole book and then realize what it's about at the end, and you're like, oh shit, and you need to do a lot of rewriting, I think that happens to people sometimes.
She seems like she had an idea like, I'm going to write this book called The Death of Harold Crick. And then she started writing, wrote like 800 pages, got to the 899th page, because it's exactly 900 pages, and was like, how do I kill this guy?
But fucking how boring is this book? Because it's just about this insurance guy that like kind of likes this woman at the bakery. And his watch, it just doesn't feel like there's any story in it beyond the story of a narrator narrating his life.
Mm-hmm. Also, my question is,
we're watching.
Whoa. My question is, in her book, are there passages about him hearing the narrator, or is the book oblivious to all this metafictional stuff happening as well? Is the book a metafictional piece?
Right. I mean, there is a point in this movie where they do meet up and she is typing, like he ran to a phone and he plugged in the number and he phoned, and then her phone rings. And I'm like, well, didn't you have to describe who he's phoning? didn't you have to know that he researched your number in the database? Anyway, we'll get there. But like, it just, sometimes this movie feels like it is definitely taking some liberties with the idea, the premise to begin with, that don't really feel like, it doesn't really feel like it ties together and makes it a cohesive thing. It feels like it gets to like choose and pick which way it has it from time to time.
For sure. Now, Harold, his life also gets shaken up when he is assigned to audit the owner of a bakery, who is played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, and she is defiantly non-compliant in paying her taxes. She's only paid 78%, and she's refused to pay the remaining 22% due to ethical concerns.
Yeah, it's an act of civil disobedience,
Yeah.
Just stick it to the man.
Yeah, and she's great in this, Maggie Gyllenhaal. I mean, she's amazing.
I mean, you just rewatched Secretary, didn't you? Come on, Rob.
No, I don't. I've never seen. Have I seen Secretary?
I don't. I've never seen it either. But yeah, she's so funny in that first scene, like when she's allowed to go 110%. She's get out of here, tax man.
Tax man.
She's so funny.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Let's play a clip of that.
Listen, I'm a big supporter of fixing potholes and erecting swing sets and building shelters. I am more than happy to pay those taxes. I'm just not such a big fan of the percentage that the government uses for national defense corporate bailouts and campaign discretionary funds. So I didn't pay those taxes. I think, actually, I sent a letter to that effect with my return.
Would be the letter that begins, "Dear Imperialist Swine."
But yeah, he's thrown off, so he has to sort of come back later to finish off. But he's struck by her. Like, this is the meet cute of the movie. She doesn't like him. He is flustered by her, and he likes it.
Yeah, yeah. And he, meanwhile, has his whole problem of figuring out what this narrator is, because we hear very quickly after he kind of meets Maggie Gyllenhaal, is that little did he know Harold Crick was going to die. And so he hears the dramatic irony and therefore collapses the fact that it is dramatic irony, because now he knows he's going to die. and he needs to figure it out. So he goes to another therapist, a better therapist than his work therapist was.
Yeah, that's right. And that's Linda Hunt. And she tells him that he is schizophrenic.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when he won't take that for an answer, she sends him to a literary theorist who's played by Dustin Hoffman. I think in the second of his great, like, I'm going to help somebody with their existential crisis roles.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's so good. That whole blanket speech.
In Huckabees?
Yeah, from My Heart Huckabees. Oh, so great. I love it. I forgot he was in this movie completely. I did not. When he came up on screen, I was like, what?
Oh, really?
He's in this movie? Because his part doesn't feel like it needs the Dustin Hoffman, you know, like he's a weighty actor, you know, he has a lot to do and perform, and in this movie he doesn't. He's just kind of like, I'm a little quirky, and I do, but he does it so well. I think he's one of the highlights of this movie for me.
For sure. I mean, I think he just does like a Dustin Hoffman-y performance, but it does, you know, he has a lot of charm that he brings to it. And he at first, he's not really interested in helping Harold. He sort of sends him off, but he becomes interested once Harold tells him about the voice and about the phrase, little did he know, which happens to be Dustin Hoffman's academic interest. He says he's written papers about this, which is like so spot on how an academic is, like completely disinterested in something that's fucking fascinating until some little minute detail comes in. They're like, oh, let's do a fucking conference.
So, did you have a good time in university, Rob?
It was okay.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to put like a lit teacher into this movie as the Mr. Miyagi to the main character. I like that a lot, and I love their kind of banter back and forth and talk about the stories and the whole exchange of like, aren't you glad you're not a golem? You know, like all that stuff was really great. I love that.
Was it possible one time that you were made of stone, wood, lye, buried corpse parts, or birth made holy by rabbinical elders?
No, look. I'm sorry, but what do these questions have to do with anything?
Nothing. The only way to find out what story you're in is to determine what stories you're not in. Odd as it may seem, I've just ruled out half of Greek literature, 7 fairy tales, 10 Chinese fables, and determined conclusively that you are not King Hamlet, Scout Finch, Miss Marple, Frankenstein's monster, or a golem.
But I also thought that, like, there should be more. Like, there should be like a little bit more of like, let's figure out if you're in a tragedy or comedy. Okay, that's fine. That's like really broad stuff. But like figuring out different things about the authorial intent, you know, all that stuff would have been really, really interesting and taking, because he's a lit professor. He doesn't just teach comedy and tragedy
at this point. So
yeah, okay, maybe. But
he's me retirement.
But yeah, I feel like you might talk about different ways of like deconstructing literature. Like, you know, there's different ways to read a book. So how are we going to read your book? Is this like biographical or deconstructionist or like feminist or you know, there's a whole bunch of ways. So like it would have been interesting to kind of get into that side of things, but I understand that they don't have much time, And and that might have seemed a little boring, to be honest. So
the matrix that he gives him to sort of test, the sort of comedy versus tragedy, is at least something that's, like, you know, memorable for people and that people easily understand. But of course, the flaw in this, which, you know, he should know as a literary theorist, is that comedy and tragedy is dependent on perspective, not upon what happens. I mean, if bad things happen to Will Ferrell over and over again, that's a comedy. It's funny.
Yeah, well, especially with Will Ferrell. Like, and that's the thing with putting a comedian into this role, is that we don't question whether it's a comedy ever. It's a comedy. We don't.
Well, the jaunty music helps too.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's not written like it's an out and out comedy, but it's sure directed and acted like it is. And I think that there might be some jokes in the script itself, but there's also some really dark stuff that I think gets a little missed because they went more for comedy than for tragedy.
Perfect. Well, I think this movie sort of embodies something that the 90s and the 2000s really embraced, was the idea of quirkiness. So, yeah, it's like, you know, has emotion and drama, but is also jokes.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, but yeah. So Harold goes back and finishes the audit with Maggie Gyllenhaal, and she gives him a rough time, gives all of the receipts and stuff in a giant box, and basically has him working like a dog all day to help her finish her taxes. And at the end of the day, as he's leaving, she offers him a cookie fresh out of the oven.
And he's not a lot of big gifts, but, you know, he really wants to at least have a cookie. And they kind of bond. And that's really nice.
They do bond. Yeah, he initially says that he doesn't like cookies, because his mom only bought him store-bought cookies.
What a cruel asshole of a mom.
Yeah. But she forces him basically to eat milk and cookies, which that was one of the sexiest things I've ever seen on screen, I think.
Jesus Christ.
I mean, it's just, you know, it's nurturing and like...
I got kind of creeped out because she just watched him eat it. And have you ever had someone just watch you eat? It's so uncomfortable.
Oh yeah, maybe.
Like
more.
Yeah, stuff yourself.
And she also tells her origin story. This is where she talks about how she came to be a baker, because she was originally went to Harvard for law, and then she ended up baking for her study partners.
I'm sure this is where, like, actual bakers in real life, like, I worked my whole life to, like, make a good muffin, and this woman, like, went to Harvard Law School first? Like, god damn it. Like, I hate you, movie. Like, I worked hard for this, and she just fell ass backwards into it.
I mean, I think people probably come to it in a lot of different ways, but I thought it was sort of interesting because, like, it's a story where, like, oh, yeah, like, okay, here's this woman who is going to be a lawyer, and she sort of gets, like, relegated to baking snacks, and then that becomes her career.
Yeah.
Like, you can read it, I mean, a few different ways. Like, are they saying, like, you know, like, are they saying that there is an element of sexism to that story, or like to her experience? I mean,
interesting.
I'm not saying that it intends to say like, well, a lawyer is a pretty big job for a woman. Wouldn't you rather be a baker? But it does seem to have like a little bit of that in it, right? Like,
right. Yeah.
Here she is. This revolutionary leftist progressive talking about going to communist meetings and fuck the man. And she has the Clash playing on her stereo. But yeah,
it's kind of like the opposite of the end of SLC Punk, where like he's like, I didn't sell out. I bought in. I'm going to change the system from within because I'm a lawyer now. They're like, she's like, fuck the system. Like all this is bullshit. I'm going to become a baker. And he's going to make recipes from the Anarchist Cookbook, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's trying to say that that's too heavy a burden for a woman. At least I hope not. It was 2005.
I hope not too, but it does seem to, like, in concert with the whole, like, Will Ferrell's mom wasn't nurturing him enough. And so now when this woman nurtures him, you know, he falls in love with her. It's sort of like, it creeps me out just a little bit.
It's interesting because they do balance it out, though, with having the author of the book be the dame herself. You know, I think that helps balance out what is usually relegated in a rom-com to being like, you know, the manic pixie dream girl or whatever.
Well, I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah.
I was just going to bring that up. Like, I would say, I mean, as much as I love this movie, and it does charm me, and I really do love Maggie Gyllenhaal, she definitely is, like, playing that part. Like, here's this woman, and, oh, she has these ideals which are so lofty and naive, and she lives this life which is perfect and cute, and she doesn't follow the rules, which I wish I could not follow the rules, but, you know, maybe she can change me just a little bit.
Dude, it's total, like, white suburban dude bait, you know? It's just like, I wish I could take off my tie and meet this, like, young hipster baker from the city, and she totally changed my world by having sex with me. Like, it's just total...
She turned me on to Marx.
Yeah, exactly.
And The Clash.
She made me listen to Spoon, and now I listen to it every day just to get me through brushing my teeth. Like, I just, yeah, I feel like it's a little bit targeting one particular audience. But,
and also, while we're talking about, like, the white person problem, we should also mention that, like, there's a little bit of Queen Latifah's character being in the super-duper magical Negro category. Once again, like, a black person is brought to help a white person figure out their shit.
Right. She had, like, a set of golfing clubs with her at the time. She's just, like,
yeah, that's right.
Walking into the office. At the end of the movie, she just vanishes, disappears.
Yeah. And I mean, like, because her character isn't, like, a huge focus, it's not as glaring as in other films, but I think it's definitely there.
There's a little bit of that. It does fall into certain categories that we're, I think, more aware of now. But this is 15 years ago. I don't know whether that forgives it, but it definitely places it within a context that these things routinely happened in. So,
So we have a few more things to get through. So the big thing is that, like, eventually he does talk to the author. He tracks her down and then calls her just as she's about to finish writing his story and basically, like, saves his own life at the last minute.
Your eyes! Your fingers! Your shoes!
Hello. I'm Harold Crick.
I know. How did you find me?
We audited you a little more than 10 years ago, and your number was in the file.
I'm sorry, but this is incredibly strange.
You're telling me.
And she sort of lets him go away with the ending. And so he initially gives it to Dustin Hoffman to read, and Dustin Hoffman tells him, sorry, this is the way that it's got to be. It's a brilliant book. It's very poignant. There's no other way to do it. Which is not really what he wants to hear.
No. So then he kind of, you know, reads the book himself. To be like, it doesn't need to end this way. Maybe I can be a writer overnight. Maybe I can rewrite this bullshit.
Yeah. He reads the whole thing on the bus. And then he tells her that, yeah, I mean, she has to end it that way. That's the only way that it can end. And he's willing to sort of accept that he is going to die. And so he goes about his day. And the big moment happens where we've seen all of these moments sort of like coming up to this point, like the woman starting her job as a bus driver, the kid on the bicycle, the apple, and then all these events happen, and this kid rides out in front of a bus, and Will Ferrell sort of saves his life, but he gets hit by the bus and presumably dies.
Mm-hmm.
However, at the last minute, it turns out that she couldn't do it. She couldn't kill him, and so she ended up making it so that he was saved by a shard of his watch, which embedded in an artery. And
total Iron Man shit. Total Iron Man shit.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, his watch was a Timex Iron Man, so
very appropriate. There you go. Nice.
Foreshadowing. Nice.
Also, you know, Dustin Hoffman asked me, like, this isn't a great ending to the book. You know, the other ending was better. Like, why would you change it? And she says that the man, like Will Ferrell, was willingly going to sacrifice his life for the end of her book. And isn't that a character that you want to keep around? I was like, no, that sounds psychotic.
Like, yeah.
Like if someone was like, I want to kill myself so that you can finish your book. You know, I'm sure George R.R. Martin has gotten that. You know, he's like, I don't want that. I just want to entertain people. Like, no, don't kill yourself.
Let me kill myself.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but so that's Stranger Than Fiction. Yeah. We'll be back after the break with some behind the scenes and trivia.
Nice.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Rewatchability. We are talking about Stranger Than Fiction. Blaine, have I got some trivia for Vu?
Hit me with it.
Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Okay. So this one's about books. I hope that you can read. What literary work does the phrase Stranger Than Fiction come from?
Oh, God, when was the first book made? I don't think they used fiction back in Shakespeare's day. I would say it's not that. And I don't know, let's say it's from a Charles Dickens book.
No, that's incorrect. It is from Lord Byron's Don Juan. And the quote is, "'Tis strange, but true, for truth is always strange, stranger than fiction, if it could be told. How much would novels gain by the exchange?"
All right, Byron.
Yeah, of course, Byron was at that famous thing where they invented Frankenstein.
Oh, right, like the writer's circle?
Yeah, and also the vampire, the first vampire story was also about him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. So we got a whole awful universal universe.
That's right. It's basically all from that one, like, writing session.
That's horrible. We had to get Tom Cruise movie out of it. Okay, go on.
Trivia the two.
Mm-hmm.
This same year, 2006, Queen Latifah also had a starring role in a movie in which her character is told that she is going to die and has to learn to live her best life. What is the name of that film?
Taxi?
No.
I can like see the poster. I can't remember the name of it. What is it?
It's I can see the poster too. It has LL Cool J and he's like holding her, right? It's Last Holiday.
Oh God, yeah, okay.
It's a remake of an Alec Guinness film from the 50s or 60s.
Guinness. Yeah, okay, go on. what's the third one?
Okay, so the third question. This film features two obvious Academy Award winners, Dustin Hoffman and Dame Emma Thompson. Who is the third actor in this film who is an Academy Award winner?
I'm going to say Queen Latifah.
Whoa, that is wrong.
Damn it.
She was nominated for Chicago, but she didn't win. Maggie Gyllenhaal was also nominated for Crazy Heart, but it was actually Linda Hunt, who plays the psychologist who tells him that he's schizophrenic. She won a Best Supporting Actress.
Can I guess the movie?
What?
Was it Incredibles?
No.
Because she was animated in The Incredibles. She looks so much like that woman. Go on. What was it?
Well, okay, so get this. It was for this movie called The Year of Living Dangerously, which is starring Mel Gibson and was directed by Peter Weir, who directed The Truman Show. But she is playing Billy Kwan, who is a male Chinese-Australian dwarf.
Yeah, I saw that movie like 3 weeks ago.
What, really?
Yeah. It's about the Indonesian. Anyway, it's an insane movie.
And well, did you realize that was that woman?
God no, she does such a good fucking job.
Well, she's an amazing performer, but problematic.
I mean, yes, it just the fact that it stars Mel Gibson means it's problematic.
Yeah, but, I mean, just like. It's 1982 when this film was made. I mean, no excuses for Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah, I was just about to say, like, she sings Moon River so well, though. I don't know.
Isn't that crazy?
That's so crazy. Good for her. That's an insane role to take on, first of all. But she does a really great job. It's so racist, but she does a really great job.
There's a few other things I should mention about this movie. It was a $30 million budget, and it did make about $53 million worldwide. So it wasn't a huge success, but not a huge failure either. I did find this great interview clip on Movie Phone, which was Will Ferrell interviewing Dustin Hoffman and Dustin Hoffman interviewing Will Ferrell. And I think I should just play a clip of this.
Is it possible that you could have fallen in love with... if you hadn't met your wife with Maggie Gyllenhaal under just normal circumstances? Because you guys seem so connected.
I had not... Yes. She's a lovely woman.
Yes.
And we really kind of connected.
You didn't have to act that bad stuff.
No.
I could tell. You felt very comfy and cozy.
Va-va-voom.
Va-va-voom indeed.
Right.
She just had a baby.
Could you have married Emma Thompson?
No.
Oh, that's great. That yeah, is so like, awkward.
Dustin Hoffman, well, I mean, you know, it's been reported that he's a creepster.
But what if your wife gave you a hall pass? Would you have stuffed Maggie Gyllenhaal? Would you have done it?
Yeah.
Why?
I have to bring this up, but like, you know, you can't talk about her performance or her abilities as an actress. She's an amazing actor.
Wouldn't you want to just like butter her bread, though? Wouldn't you want to just see her above the top? I don't know. This, yeah, that's so horrible. That's not great at all.
Yeah, I want to play another clip too. This one's a little bit more germane to the discussion.
If someone gave you a completed book of the rest of your life, would you open it?
Are there illustrations?
You want to know what tomorrow brings?
No,
you don't.
I don't think so.
No, but you know there are people who would like to afford it. They go and have these scans, these MRIs, and scans. Yeah. They want to know, being able to tell you certain genetic places that what you're going to get. You want to know what you're going to get.
If you were relatively assured that you could live, would you have your head frozen?
Wait, would you have your head cryogenically frozen, Rob?
I already have.
You're just like in the freezer right now. That's not how it works, man.
That was the best acoustics for recording.
Just old peas frozen to your hair.
Oh, the last thing is that this movie is a gold mine for college essay writing services. Like, if you need to write an essay for your film or English class, there are like a billion that have been written on this by somebody else that you can purchase.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but that's the thing about it is that that's the thing about this movie is that it kind of tries to have its cake and eat it too. Like when he meets Emma Thompson at the end, she's like, "How did you get my number? And, you know, what did you think of this?" You know what he thinks of that. You know how he got your number because you wrote his life.
And yeah.
if like he could choose to do something different, he would have. And that's the thing that like, I don't get in the movie writing business, the character goes for their goal and his goal is to not die. And so, and to understand what's happening to him. And he tries to understand in the first part of the second act all the time. And then the second part, he kind of just like finally meets her and then realizes he needs to die and doesn't try to not die anymore. And that is so sad. And I think way more depressing than Eternal Sunshine in a big way. Like at the beginning, right, we were talking about like how, you know, the movies in this room, the elephants in the room are Eternal Sunshine, or like Charlie Kaufman movies, but they were so depressing. But I find this movie, he just kind of gives up. I guess, like, that feels so horrible and so wrong and so not true to the character and what he's found. I mean, he's found someone he loves and he's finally living his life. And he goes, "I'll give it up so that you can have a bestseller."
Like, isn't living your life being willing to give it up?
No.
Oh, no? Oh, okay. Well, what about like, you know, the heroes out there, the healthcare workers and all those? Are you saying that a character in a book isn't as much of a hero as a person?
I'm saying they're taking calculated risks in order to save more lives.
I'm saying that if people have to die for our entertainment, that's just something that we have to accept, you know?
This is like Gladiator.
Reopen the streets. Reopen the movie theaters.
Reopen the Colosseum. I think it could have been a really more interesting movie if it didn't try to be a rom-com at the same time. Mm-hmm. And like for him to try to do something that she isn't writing, or like maybe when she's not writing, he can live his own life. But then when she gets a typewriter, you know, does he feel control? This is determinism versus free will. Like that's a huge, like lot of a quagmire of a debate. And there's a lot to come out of that, like in terms of like storytelling, and they just don't approach it at all. Like, does he have control over his own life, or is she, or is he willingly kill himself, or is she murdering him?
Like, well, we also don't know whether she's actually controlling things. I mean, everything that she types happens, but is it that she just has some sort of telepathic link to the world or something?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it leaves a lot to be desired in terms of the metaphysics of it, but I think that, you know, it's as a love story and as a romance, it does work. And as a story about like an everyman character, like I think it has something to say about, you know, going out there and living your life and all of that stuff, which maybe not the, you know, most unique message, but it's one that we all need to hear sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. It is kind of, it's light, it's airy, it's positive. And sometimes we need a movie like that when life isn't positive or light or airy.
So do you think this is rewatchable for you?
I think it's mildly rewatchable. I don't know if I'm ever going to watch it again, but I was entertained and watching it for the second time after 15 years of not watching it. So yeah, I'd say it's mildly rewatchable. There are some, we've already talked about the problematic nature of it and the fact that it didn't go as deep as it could have. But yeah, maybe this is the first year essay on the subject, and you know, something like
it's a gateway.
Synecdoche, New York is more the fourth year term.
You don't want to start with Synecdoche, New York.
So yeah, I think there is a lot of value to be gained from being the gateway drug. You know, we all love marijuana. So
we all love marijuana.
You're like, I second that.
Especially now.
essential service. And yeah. So I would say mildly rewatchable. What about you, Rob?
I also think it's, I'm going to say it's rewatchable. I think it's more rewatchable than I thought it would be. Mm. I think it's delightful. There are problems that I have with it as like, you know, Mr. Movie Critic, but I really just want to put some of those aside and enjoy the film for what it is. And it has a lot of elements that are really enjoyable. And it's funny. There are parts that really make me laugh. I really enjoy Will Ferrell's performance. I really enjoy Maggie Gyllenhaal's performance. Dustin Hoffman is also fun. So, I mean, I think it's, I think it's a rewatchable one.
Yeah.
And that's rewatchability for this week. So you can find us on Apple Podcasts, where you can rate us and leave a review. You can engage with us on Twitter or Facebook. We'd love to hear from you. And if you have a movie you want us to watch, you can engage with us there about that too. And you can also go to Patreon and make a donation there, $1, $3, $5, any amount that you want. And that helps us keep the podcast going. And anything else before we go, Blaine?
He asked Blaine inquisitively.
I wasn't that inquisitive.
He said defiantly.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.